This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Well, thank you very much, Roger, and good morning as we come to you live from our Huntley studios this morning, and welcome to the Saturday morning show. Between now and 6 o'clock, we'll talk technology and we'll talk markets, and we'll talk about some of the events that are going on right now, because starting today, the annual convention of the Illinois Farm Bureau. So your opportunity to shake a farmer's hand this weekend, because they're coming to Chicago, holding their annual convention as they do every December. And we certainly say welcome to the members of the Illinois Farm Bureau as they determine policy and other activities for the year just ahead. And they'll probably try to figure out a way to stay alive in a market that has dropped, in some commodity cases, by nearly half in the last year and a half to 2 years. So some challenges ahead for the Illinois Farm Bureau. And this is the time of year when State Farm Bureau conventions are held in Indiana and Wisconsin and Iowa and Michigan and all over the country. The State Farm Bureaus come together in convention to determine their policy and recommendations to the American Farm Bureau Federation that will hold its annual convention in Orlando, Florida in January. Hey, they're no dummies. They know that it's good to get out of the winter weather and the cold temperatures in the north and head to warmer climates for their annual meeting. National Cattlemen's Beef Association later in January will be meeting in San Diego, California. So it gives us the opportunity to go to some very nice places in the cold of the Midwest winter. So welcome to the Illinois Farm Bureau and welcome to our Saturday morning show. Max Armstrong is going to be talking to Greg Groh of Archer Financial Services a little later in the show this morning. And we're going to talk about weather, and we'll talk about markets. We had quite a week on Wall Street and in the commodity world this week, and that's probably not going to slow down for a while. But it was a fascinating week in the world of business, and it's a global world, definitely, because Thursday, the European Central Bank disappointed investors by not taking some actions that they were expecting. And then yesterday, we got more information that indicates we will get the first increase in interest rates in this country in 10 years when the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee meets next week on the 15th and 16th. That they'll be meeting. And so many economists, after the release of the employment numbers yesterday, said this just about nails it, that we're going to quit talking about increasing the interest rate and doing it. So that coming up, and then the decision by OPEC that they announced yesterday, they are not going to cut production. The basic OPEC countries, who are getting pressured by other OPEC members who are not quite as wealthy as countries like Saudi Arabia, but Saudi Arabia says we'll keep the prices where they are, we'll keep production where it is, and we'll put more downward pressure on the American shale oil industry, which is certainly showing up. We'll talk about some of the discussions in Minnesota, even though Minnesota isn't in the oil patch, but their neighbor North Dakota is. And with the cuts in labor in the oil patch of North Dakota, we're looking for people who are losing jobs and looking for other jobs. So coming up, a lot of technology that's adding to the ability to produce food for a growing world. We keep hearing, and it's probably fact, between now and the year 2050, we're going to add 2 billion people to the planet we're not adding any more land to produce food to feed the 2 billion people. So we're going to have to use technology like GMO and other technology that we're designing in plant genetics and in equipment to harvest the new crops. We're going to have to use more of that if we're going to feed the growing world population. So it takes a lot of money to conduct the science and find the technology that will do what we needed to do. We're going to talk about that with a guest that joined us at the Farm Broadcasting Convention in Kansas City last month. We'll get to that when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. Jeff Cecil with Syngenta joins us at the annual meeting of the National Association of Farm Broadcasting. As we look at this industry to make crops better and produce more yields, I'm fascinated by the amount of research work that your company and others do to do this. Never ending.
No, it's never ending, that's for sure. We spend, Syngenta spends about $1.3 billion per year on research and development, trying to bring the next new technology to market, trying to really focus on what the grower needs are, and understanding those needs so that we can develop on our strengths.
And consumers are always bombarded with various stories saying all of this stuff is dangerous. How much testing and how much time does it take to really bring a new product online?
Well, that's a great question. The consumer certainly is bombarded with a lot of information, some of which is true, some of which is not. And I think the thing that the consumer should understand is we spend about 15 years or more sometimes developing products and going through the trials and understanding of what that product does so that we can be sure that we're bringing the safe product to market.
And how often will you work with a product for 10 years and then find out, no, maybe this isn't going to work and all that money is gone?
Yeah, more times than we'd like to admit. There is something that happens on a product, and certainly we research a lot more products than what we ever bring to market. But the reality is we're trying to limit that spend in vain so that we can have good products to market as quickly as we can get them.
So talk to me about the performance of some of your newer products in the crop year just ending.
Yeah, so the 2015 season brought us the introduction of a very exciting new product called Acuron.
Yes.
We received federal registration for that product in April of this year and brought it just in time for the corn season. We were fortunate enough to be able to get it on many farms across the Corn Belt, and the results that we've seen have been fantastic. Customer satisfaction is extremely high, getting good control across a broad spectrum of weeds.
So does it apply to a full spectrum of weeds, and what about application?
Right, so it is a full spectrum. If there is such a thing as full spectrum, I think there's always
right.
a weed out there that's hard to get. The interesting thing with Acuron is it does get a lot of those weeds that have been kind of difficult to control over the years, like giant ragweed and water hemp and even resistance water hemp that we're seeing across the Midwest. So it's given us three modes of action with four different active ingredients that control a broad range of pests in all different types of conditions. It can be applied in an early pre-plant application all the way through an early post.
Oh.
So it's a very broad a range of application and pest as well.
How concerned should producers be about resistance?
Well, I think resistance should be on the mind of everybody, because if you drive across the Midwest in particular, just take a drive across Interstate 70, before the harvest, you would have seen a tremendous amount of weeds, and these weeds are not there because they're easy to control. There's certainly a lot of resistance showing up in that area, and it's moving further north all the time. Once you have a resistance, you're taking tools out of your toolbox. So we've been very fortunate to have a product like glyphosate in the market that gave us a very efficient way to control weeds, and now that we see resistance, we're having to spend more and really take more time to manage that control of weeds. So I think every farmer should be aware and concerned.
Is the industry staying ahead of the resistance game so far?
We spent the better part of 10 or 15 years not doing enough research into control of resistance weeds, and now we're doing a bit of catch-up. I think Syngenta is in the fortunate position to have continued with a lot of that work. And as a result of that, we'll introduce 19 new active ingredients over the next 5 years, most of which will have a a very strong presence in the United States. So obviously those aren't all herbicides, but they're new active ingredients that we'll be bringing to market and will help us in the control of things like resistance.
So let's talk about the pipeline and the products that you can talk about now that is in the future for producers.
Sure. I think, you know, we like to focus on what's real, and what's real is in the next 2 to 3 years. In the next 2 years, we'll introduce two major new active ingredients in the fungicide space on top of the herbicide space that we're already launching into now with Acuron. We'll have a product called TrivaPro that we'll bring to market in 2016. We just received registration for that 2 months ago, and we are ready to go to market with it. The TrivaPro will be the hardest working, longest lasting fungicide on the market for control. It works about 10 times harder. The data would show that this product is out there working longer than anything we've seen so far.
And one final question on supply and availability. You're waiting for approval. Are you at the same time manufacturing to be ready to go the instant you get that approval?
Well, we really have some best-in-class people working in our production field. And what they do generally is they have products ready to go the minute we get registration. A good example of that is what we did with Acuron. We received a registration for that April the 24th. In 48 hours, we had product in the field ready to go. And so we had state registrations in a couple of key states within that 48 hours. This doesn't happen because we don't have people that are really prepared for what has to happen when you get the federal registration. So I feel very confident that we will have supply available for us as we move forward.
Thank you for the visit and the education.
Thank you very much.
Okay, a visit with Jeff Cecil with Syngenta. For the past 9 months, Chris Hodges has served as Chief Executive Officer of the National Pork Producers. We have the opportunity to sit down and talk about the pork industry here at the Farm Broadcasting Convention. Chris, you've already in 9 months seen some very interesting things happen in the pork market, haven't you?
Absolutely. I started in the first quarter, which was a pretty rough quarter for the U.S. pork market.
Do a quick review on the challenges you had in that first quarter.
We started the year coming out of PED, which was a good thing. I mean, a year ago, that's all anybody could talk about. And as a credit to the pork industry, we came out of PED really well, but we ended up with a lot more meat in the first quarter than what we thought we were going to have. And at the same time, you know, the Russians were shutting their market off to the Europeans and to us, and then we also had the West Coast slowdown, so we got lost some market share to the Europeans in Asia. So that's what we saw, a pretty steep slide in prices, if you remember, last first quarter.
Almost the perfect storm on the negative side.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And markets don't like those kinds of surprises. So as markets do, we overreacted, I think, a little bit. And then as we came in second quarter, we kind of righted ourselves, and domestic demand was fantastic. As we went through quarters two and three, we saw things happening domestically no one had anticipated. And it was
Why was that?
Well, we'd been working real hard, National Pork Board, on the food service side. We'd been teamed up with a lot of big national operators on menu development. We have a fantastic group of chefs that we're working with them, and you can find pulled pork in a lot of places now that you couldn't 2 years ago. So that was a big factor. Bacon just was a fantastic summer on bacon sales. So those two areas helped us a lot, and the Pork Board, I'm proud to say, had something to do with that in the food service area. And then on the retail side, we were the fastest growing protein in both food service and retail, actually, during the summer months and into the third quarter. So we saw September and October prices held better than anybody thought they would. Now here in November, we've seen a little weakness. This is that time of year. We got big slaughters, weights are up, and we've got more meat than we were ready for, I think, from a demand side. And retailers want to talk about turkeys this time of year.
It's the turkey time of the year. What about World Health Organization? Even though they backed off, that didn't make page one. Is it having an impact, you think?
Oh, it's a great characterization. Didn't make page one. We were very concerned about, obviously. But I think as the U.S. public learned more about this organization and looked at the list of items they had that are carcinogenic,
yes,
people were starting to feel a little a little unhappy about, you know, wine, coffee, pickles is my favorite one.
Yep.
And plus, I was it was interesting that a lot of American consumers were actually, I think, angered by the fact bacon was on that
list. Right. Well, you get bacon in just about everything. And one of the stories I did as a sidebar to the World Health Organization, the oldest woman in the world, 116 years old, says part of her secret of long life is bacon and eggs every morning for breakfast.
Perfect. Yeah, I picked up on that as well.
Yeah. So looking ahead, will we be able to regain some of that foreign market, you think?
Pork Board's working really hard in Asian markets in particular, yep, where we've lost that market share, doing a lot of promotion over there. You know, we work with the Meat Export Federation and in all those markets, and they have an excellent staff over there. So promotion's gonna be a big part of 2016. Korea's been good all along, but Japan is where we got hurt badly, and China. Those are two markets we need to get that market share back.
Looking ahead, the final pig crop report of the year, any guesses? Are we increasing production or backing away?
Yeah, we're in an expansion, but it's a very modest one. I think it's just the kind of expansion you want to see. You don't want any one of these big surprises to come along on supply. We can build demand at the same rate we're building production right now. I feel pretty good about that going into 2016. It looks like it'll be a decent year for pork producers once we work out of this kind of seasonal decline that I talked about earlier.
And support for the checkoff continues?
We do a survey every year, and we've never had more support from pork producers than we have right now.
Good. You got to have some money in the game.
Absolutely.
In order to sell the product. Chris, thank you very much, and we will look forward to visiting with you over the months and the years. Chris Hodges, who is Chief Executive Officer of the National Pork Board. Thank you very much, Roger, and hearing you talk about freezing fog and fog, yesterday was an interesting weather day because I had to fly to Worthington, Minnesota. Air Orion, that's about 2 hours and 15 minutes. And we were going to take off from Aurora, and fog right down on the ground, zero visibility. Now, you can take off in that in an airplane, but most pilots say, I don't want to take off from an airport that I can't get back into if I have to. And that was certainly the case with the fog at Aurora yesterday. So after an hour and a half sitting on the ground, we finally got about a half-mile visibility, and we said, okay, we'll take off. We took off, climbed to 1,800 feet on the way up to 4,000 feet, broke out of the clouds, and yesterday, Roger, was the most perfect December winter day, not a cloud in the sky. Once we got above 1,800 feet, and once we traveled to west of DeKalb, everything was beautifully clear. So you can never really count on what the weather is going to do to you. So,
I love getting up above the clouds.
Yeah, and seeing clouds from both sides.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Have a great one, Orion.
Thank you very much. Today it'll not be Air Orion, it'll be the automobile as we make our annual Christmas trip to visit the Samuelson family up in Westby, Wisconsin. So if any of you listening this morning are going to be in Westby at the Old Town Inn for dinner tonight, I'll see you there because we make two eating stops in Westby in the Old Town Inn and Borgen's Cafe that when it closed a couple of decades ago got a front page story on the New York Times because it was such a stopping place for the pre-interstate highway system for people from Chicago going to the Twin Cities. And that's where they'd stop and have lunch. It was about the halfway mark. So anyway, we'll be there this evening and certainly look forward to that. Now we say welcome to Samuelson Says, sponsored by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson, and this week, sympathy for the oil companies? Not for me. I'll talk about it when we continue. Well, it finally happened. They were well over a year late, but finally the Environmental Protection Agency announced the amount of renewable energy that we should be using in our diesel and gasoline over, well, the year that has already ended, 2014, 2015 coming to an end. And that revised formula for the renewable fuel standard, I don't think made anybody really happy. Ethanol producers, soy diesel producers, and corn and soybean farmers felt that the EPA did not follow the wishes of Congress when they passed the use of the renewable fuels back in 2007. And certainly the oil companies cranked up their public relations machine to start saying, this is going to be bad news for us and bad news for you. I quote one news release, U.S. oil companies will likely pay close to $1 billion this year to put more ethanol and renewables in gasoline and diesel and face even higher compliance costs in 2016 after the U.S. government set its targets for alternative fuel use above industry expectations. And then the oil companies go on to say higher costs could be passed on to consumers, pushing fuel prices higher and prompting further calls to bring about some reductions in those renewable energy quotas. And the EPA's targets, they say, can be met by blenders blending biofuels such as ethanol into gasoline, or by buying credits known as renewable identification numbers. But all you have to do until, remember till June a year ago, when those quarterly earnings reports from the oil companies showed how many of our dollars were going into their pockets, I can't feel sorry for the oil industry, but boy, they don't want to give up any part of their market. And yet, we're going to start having to use, I think, more renewable sources. They've kind of forgotten history. Back in 79, the oil embargo, when you would sit in line for hours waiting to get limited amounts of gasoline because the Middle East oil-producing countries said we want higher prices, so we're just going to withhold oil. And we quickly learned that we could be held hostage in the world economy by countries in the Middle East, most of them who didn't like us. So I'm not going to have any sympathy for the oil industry. They have been making money, they're making money, and it's time that maybe they did a little bit more for the environment by using ethanol that can be produced every year on farms in the United States and not have to ship oil from Saudi or Iran or that part of the world. So no sympathy from me for the oil companies, and that's my thoughts on Samuelson Says. A couple of other things. While we're speaking of oil, yesterday the OPEC countries, at least the wealthier ones, said we're not going to cut production despite the fact we have an oversupply. And that sent the oil market lower yesterday after that report came out. And it was a busy weekend for reports, whether it was the Labor Department employment report or the report from Vienna, Austria, where the OPEC countries are holding a two-day meeting to determine what direction they're going. So we'll get to what's happening in the agricultural commodity world. And Max Armstrong will sit down with his guest when we continue on the Saturday Morning Show.
Archer Financial Services, the firm. Greg Groh is the guy joining us at the microphone this weekend. It is always good to see you. Hope your holiday season is going well thus far, sir.
Very good so far, Max, and I hope the same for you.
Thank you. It is. Does it tend to be at a quieter time in the commodity trade? I mean, I can think of years that there may have been some big stories developed during the holidays that moved the markets one way or another, but typically, do you see the volume fall?
And I think this year especially, commodities are somewhat out of favor in the money world, as we all know, as we watched the declines in these markets over the last year and a half. And I think that, coupled with the holiday environment, reduces volume and makes things somewhat choppy at times when markets do move.
We saw some activity related to the dollar in recent days, and that was reflected a little bit, was it not, in some gyrations in commodity prices?
Certainly, it's a background story, and when we see the dollar strengthening near recent highs or five-year highs or eight-year highs, you know, that kind of takes its toll on U.S. commodity values as it makes it harder for us to compete in the global market. And days when the dollar drops, certainly it brings a little more interest back on our side and makes things more competitive on our side. So it's an interesting type of a situation, and the dollar, recent dollar strength has been one of the negatives in the commodity world in general here in the U.S.
Is the Fed poised to move interest rates, and when they do, will it affect commodities?
Well, you know, that's been the big thing all year, is when is the Fed going to move? And from my perspective, a 0.25% increase, it really doesn't mean much in the nearby, but it does set the stage for further rate increases as we go forward. And if we've truly turned the tide and the U.S. economy is strengthening to the point where the Fed feels it can begin a tightening process, certainly it will have effects on things as we go forward. But, you know, I think the economic news that we see each week is very highly variable week to week. And even though the Fed may move here at the end of the year, what they do next year is, I think, a bit of a up for grabs.
This first step, if they do take it, indeed, as many expect, and as the Fed seems to be quietly signaling, it may not necessarily be followed by another uptick when the Open Market Committee meets in 2016.
I would agree with that. I think they'll have to wait and watch and see events in Europe, how China stimulates and what happens there. I think they're going to take a very patient and concerted view at this.
In terms of global supply and demand, the demand, as we're watching it, China continues to buy soybeans, do they not?
They are. They've been aggressive here in the U.S. We were pretty competitive. Events in Brazil and uncertainty there has reduced some of the offerings coming out of Brazil recently, and that's brought more business here to the U.S. It'll be very interesting to see. Right now, we're just beginning the heart of the growing season in South America. It's just like being here on June 1st in North America. China is a global player in this. They're going to watch events there very closely. If weather cooperates and high yield potential is there by January, I expect that'll reduce U.S. demand as China will tend to favor South American supplies going from that point forward. But if a weather upset occurs and yield potential begins to decline there, we may see additional business here out of the U.S. We are a very reliable supplier. And remember, despite the propensity for a giant crop in South America, the ability to get it from the field and onto a boat is a different story. And that has been a backdrop here for many years. For those who look at the South American supply as being a very bearish situation, we have to remember it takes time to get it into the marketing channels.
We heard a little bit of talk in recent days about the fact they've had only scattered showers across the major soybean producing area of Mato Grosso in Brazil, and that was after a dry November. I guess it's a little bit too early for excitement over that, but it bears watching?
It is worth watching. That northeast part of the country has been dry. The south has been, in some cases, way too wet, so it's uneven. Generally, conditions across the country outside of that dry area are mostly favorable, but they're going to need good rains in late December and early January to ensure crop yield potential there. And the same thing as we go into Argentina. Situation there is good. Moisture is good. Planting progress is well underway, but they're going to need the type of rain that we like to see in July and August frame of things. It'll be late December and January there. The weather will be very important and will set the stage.
Do you sense that there is any immediate switch of acreage taking place in Argentina after the runoff election that they had at the presidency and the removal of some of those export taxes?
Reading some of the comments coming from there, it appears that they're going to come back and maybe plant 10% more acreage in corn and wheat than maybe had been anticipated early. Remember, up until the election, it was all about cost, and corn, a high-cost item there for producers, made them want to favor soy. But with the election and the December 10th talk of dropping the export tax there on wheat and corn, I think it's going to bring back some wheat and corn acres for Argentina this year.
Soybeans, no immediate immediate effect there?
I don't think so. I think they'll have the type of acreage base there that the USDA suggested in their early outlook for Argentina. We may find that soybean acres on the margin will drop a little bit as we pick up some corn and wheat acres, but I don't think it's enough to really alter the overall potential for a soy crop in Argentina.
Long term, though, I mean, this seems like it's a very significant shift in that country that has tremendous potential. If I picked up on the vibes correctly from the farmers there with whom I visited as this year began when I was traveling there, they were just hoping against hope that they could get some kind of a change in the presidential palace.
Well, I think long term it's going to increase the ability for Argentine farmers to be more aggressive in marketing, which will, in the case of corn and wheat, make them very competitive against the U.S., and that'll be a question for us of maintaining market share, especially if the dollar continues to strengthen this year. The Argentine growers are holding on to, in some cases, a year or maybe 2 years' worth of crop there, and that's going to start to come to town here pretty quick, and that's going to be a competitive influence in the world market, especially in corn and wheat.
So they have quite a bit stored.
My understanding is that they've stored at least one full year and perhaps in some cases two. Uncertainty there makes the Argentine producers, the ownership of corn and wheat and beans in storage is their store of value. Helps to maintain a sense of wealth that cannot be taken by currency fluctuations and government policies. So, if a more of a pro-market government exists and makes the type of moves that the farm sector believes are important to them, I expect it'll make create a more aggressive marketing situation and allow Argentine growers to re-enter back into the global marketplace.
In terms of significant USDA numbers in the weeks ahead, what reports are you anticipating that you'll be watching for some guidance?
Well, this is kind of a slow period. We have a slight supply-demand report next week, and I don't expect a lot of changes. The next major report for us is in January, the final crop report. And when we see the type of yield increases we saw late season this year going into our November crop report, generally we'll see a steady to slightly higher yield on that January final report. So hard to come up with anything here in December that's going to be a big mover in the market. We've had a nice recovery here in soybeans recently due to this Chinese buying. It'll also kind of start to mesh a little bit with probably increased U.S. producer selling as we start into the next new year.
Farmers certainly need to watch for those signals anytime they get an uptick in price.
This is a type of environment, and I'll continue to believe, as I've had throughout this last year, that when we do see rally attempts in the market, for whatever reason they are marketing opportunities here for U.S. growers, as we are sitting in generally surplus positions on a global basis, and we need to be able to compete.
Thanks, Greg. Always good to talk to you. Come back and see us sometime.
Thank you, Max.
Greg Groh, Archer Financial Services.
4.5 minutes before 6 o'clock news time here on WGN Radio Chicago, and talking about the renewable fuel standards. The Illinois Farm Bureau will more than likely be talking about that at the annual convention this weekend. They get underway today. Incidentally, Max Armstrong will be there tomorrow afternoon to sign books. For any of you who want Max's book entitled In the Heartland, and he'll be at that convention tomorrow afternoon for that. But one of those who was not happy with the announcement from the EPA was Rich Gebert, who is the president of the Illinois Farm Bureau, and he said the figures for this year and next year announced this week fall short of the amount of renewable fuel specified by law. And he went on to say that while EPA properly took into account updated projections of increased motor fuel demand in arriving at their 18 billion gallon target for next year, the agency unfortunately continues to buy into the oil industry's complete unwillingness to make the infrastructure investments necessary to give consumers a choice of higher blend levels and lower prices at the pump. I was in Minnesota the past week on 3 different trips. They do have pumps that will deliver, I think, about 4 different percentages of renewable energy all the way up to E85. And you can punch the button for whatever you want, E10, E15, E85, or whatever. And it happens. Oil industry says, oh, too busy, too expensive, can't do that. Well, next week it'll be back to visiting with farmers in Minnesota and Wisconsin, Menominee, Wisconsin, Rochester, Minnesota, St. Cloud, Minnesota, and Fairmont, Minnesota, where they had really quite a crop this year. As the president of the Minnesota Farm Bureau said to me at Farm Fest back in August, he said, we've had a couple of bad years in Minnesota, so it's our turn. And boy, this year we've got it. And it held all the way through harvest time. So you'll be meeting some of these Illinois farmers on the streets of Chicago the next 2 or 3 days. Your chance to, as I always say, shake a farmer's hand. And we hope you will do that. The other comment I would make, flying yesterday, and the fun thing about flying at 4,500 feet rather than 35,000 in an airliner, you get a good look at what's happening below you. We flew across northern Illinois, across most of Iowa, and then up into Minnesota to Worthington. And the only place we really saw snow on the ground was in southwestern Minnesota. They got about 11 inches. But that snow made a perfect white blanket of land. And as I looked down at the acres and acres and acres that produce food for America and the world, I couldn't help but imagine every year they take chances with weather and markets and everything else, but every acre of that land has to be gone over at least 3 times by farm equipment. And I just thought about the fuel cost alone of producing the food and then the additional cost of trucking it to the processor, trucking it to the wholesaler, and trucking it to the retail outlet. It really is quite a system for food production that we have in the U.S., and we should be thankful for it. Well, I'll have a nice couple of days in Westby, Wisconsin. I hope you have nice days wherever you are. And that's our time here for the Saturday morning show. So on behalf of Max Armstrong, I'm Orion Samuelson saying thank you for joining us on Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago and WGNRadio.com. We're at 6 o'clock. Time for the news. Good morning, Rob Hart.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.